Our gospel lesson this morning comes from the 16th chapter of the Gospel of Luke. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried in Hades, where he was in torment. He looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me, and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you is a great chasm, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." He answered, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my family, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead." This morning, we are continuing with a sermon series that we started a few weeks ago on the parables that we find only in the Gospel of Luke. And our parable today is an interesting one. Before we begin with the parable, just a few sports stories. I'm not much of a big athlete, but I just thought I'd tell you a few of these. The first one I remember was a story from when I was teaching in Pequot Lakes, and one of my students was a running back in the football team. And in this one particular game, I remember he was running down this. He just picked up a fumble or he'd caught a pass? I don't recall. But he's running down the sidelines about to make a touchdown, and he decides that he's all that. And he looks back at the stands, and he stumbles, and he falls. He's about 3 yards short of the goal line, and his team can't quite drive it in, and the Pequot team loses the game. He turned around and looked back at the stands. A few other stories that I heard that I read about this week. One was a famous one. From the 1929 Rose Bowl game, when Roy Wrongway Regals went the wrong way and scored for the other team, and his team lost the game. In basketball, just a couple of things in the last few years, there was a fellow by the name of Ryan Potochnik, who in the state tournament of a high school basketball in Georgia, this is one of their team leading scorers. He got the pass and inexplicably he dribbled to the other end and scored for the other team. He'd gotten turned around on the basketball court, and the buzzer rang and the game was over. Or another one, this is in 2013, when a ball player tried to save a ball from going out of bounds in the closing seconds of the game. He grabbed the ball and threw it over his shoulder, and it went into the other team's basket. Now, my experience with basketball works something like this. I was a ninth grader, and I attempted to play basketball in elementary school and junior high. However, with my eyesight, I more than likely just ran into the opposite wall instead of actually doing a layup. But in ninth grade, I was playing some ball, but they also were having me do some stats. And I remember that I actually have 2 points on the books in my name. But here's the only reason why. The only reason why was because I was on the court when a guy from the other team scored a basket in the wrong side of the court, and I was the closest player. Our sermon title today is Making Life Count. And we're looking at the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. As we look at these parables, a few questions to think about. How does this parable help me to understand what God is like? How does this parable help me to understand myself? And how does this parable help me to understand God's will for my life? And you might notice that in the bulletin, I've left some space underneath the area where the sermon is, for you to be able to jot a few things down if there's some things during the sermon today that you find particularly useful. Well, our parable today is actually one of Jesus' most controversial parables. Some have even suggested that this isn't a parable because it doesn't really meet the definition of the parable that I gave a few weeks ago. A parable is an earthly story with a heavenly meaning, but this seems to be a heavenly story with an earthly meaning. And so maybe it's not quite the same sort of category. The other thing that some people have pointed out is that this one is unique because this is the only parable that we have recorded in any of the Gospels where a character in the parable is named. Lazarus is named. Now, I think that that's important, and we'll come back to that in a few minutes. Another thing that makes this parable somewhat unique is that some people have constructed an entire theology of heaven and hell on this one parable. I personally think that's a little bit dangerous, because there's a whole bunch to consider in the Bible regarding heaven and regarding hell and regarding what happens after we die. And I think this parable probably isn't the best place to define all of that theology. Some people have even suggested that this picture of heaven and hell that Jesus paints in this parable is more of a sarcastic parody of what the Pharisees believed than it was actually Jesus' own theology. He was trying to make a different point. He wasn't trying to describe exactly what might happen after we die. let's start in by taking a look again at the story. And so I'm just going to ask Michelle if she could go back to the gospel reading at the beginning, and we'll take a look at some things from this parable that might just lead us to a greater understanding of what Jesus is trying to say. Well, first Jesus says that there is a rich man. And he describes this rich man. He doesn't name the rich man. Now, tradition has given this rich man a name. In the Middle Ages, a lot of people invented stories sort of to expound upon the scriptures. And in the Middle Ages, the rich man was given the name Dives, which I think is quite interesting. It literally means rich man from Latin. But you might hear something interesting in that name. Dives actually has the same root as the word divine. And that tells us something about how people oftentimes think of riches. Riches is something that is given by God. It's divinely appointed. Some people believe for certain people to be rich and other people to be poor. I do think that riches represent blessings, but what we do with those blessings is another question. He's described as wearing a purple robe. Well, that's actually quite interesting and would have said something to people in the first century that I don't think it says today. I see a few people with purple on today. Joyce is wearing purple. Kate's wearing purple. There might be a few other purple garments out there. And I'm guessing that the fact that Joyce and Kate are wearing purple doesn't suggest to us, I see Liz is wearing purple also, doesn't suggest to us that these three individuals are being ostentatious in their wealth. But that's what Jesus would have been implying. Because see, there were two types of purple dye available in the first century. Both of them were considered expensive dyes. One of them was actually derived from a beetroot. And that was from Western Turkey. You might know the character of Lydia from later on in Acts. She was a seller of purple cloth, and she was probably selling this sort of cloth. It was expensive, not as expensive as the other type. This would have been sort of a kind of violet purple, but a deep, rich purple people-eater purple was a different kind of purple. And that was only derived by the ink, by extracting the ink of a small predatory snail-like gastropod, a little mollusk. And you had to take the mollusk out of the shell and squeeze it. And every mollusk would, you could extract just a few drops of this rich, deep purple. You had to get about 1,000 of these little mollusks to dye enough cloth to make a robe out of. And so the idea of this man dressing in a purple robe would have meant that he was wealthy and he was ostentatious about his wealth. He showed it off as he walked down the streets. That's what we see in his outer garment. But Jesus also describes his inner garment. Fine linen, he says. Now, it's translated into the words fine linen in English, but actually the original Greek says woven air. Now, what does that mean? Well, woven air was a description of this really delicate fibers that were woven, and they would have been soft and sumptuous and very, very expensive. In fact, some historians suggest that this fabric was worth its weight in gold. That's how much this woven air would have cost the rich man. And he wore that as his undergarments. That's where you wear fine white linen. So perhaps we could get something out of what Jesus was saying about this man, both on the outside and on the inside. This man is concerned with his own luxury, with pampering himself. It also says that this man feasts sumptuously every day. He's living in luxury. Most people of the first century ate a really bare bones diet. And this man feasts. See, this guy's identity is caught up in his wealth. He sees himself as a winner. Now, Lazarus, on the other hand, is described quite differently. Lazarus is named, as I said, and his name is quite interesting. It actually, the name Lazarus is a Greek translation of the Hebrew name Eleazar, or otherwise sometimes translated Lazar, or in Macedonian, Lazo. And our pastor at the Methodist church that we were at in Macedonia was named Pastor Lazo. Lazar, or Eleazar, means God is my helper. To me, that says something about Lazarus, to know what his name meant. Part of it, I think, is the fact that this is a man of faith. But he is described as helplessly crippled. In fact, in the text that we have, it says, at his gate was laid a beggar. Now, that sounds gentle and nice. The Greek actually says something more like, at his gate was tossed or dumped a beggar. This is a man who was rather unceremoniously dumped on a garbage pile. When we were in Korea, we had a place that we had to pass on our way to school every morning that we affectionately called Stinky Garbage Pile Corner, because that's where everybody came and dumped their garbage. In the U.S., you know, we bag our garbage in plastic bags and we run it up to the recycled center. But most countries have, in traditional cities, a place that you dump the garbage. And of course you're going to put the garbage where there's already the most garbage. And this rich guy has evidently got a lot of garbage to get rid of, because that's where people are dumping their trash, at his gates. It says that he longed to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Well, you know, when I was little, I used to think of this guy maybe crawling into the dining room and like trying to get things off of the floor that the guy was tossing down. But really what we're talking about here is this guy longed to get the food that he was hauling out from his daily banquets. In the first century, people that were rich didn't use napkins like we think of napkins. Oftentimes they would buy extra bread. They'd wipe their face with bread and they'd wipe their fingertips off with bread. And so this guy's throwing away bread that he's tossed away just out of his abundance. It wasn't really scraps of maybe a little leftovers that he didn't eat. This was food that he was throwing away intentionally. And this man longed to eat this. It says that the dogs came and licked his sores. Now, one sore would make a man ceremonially unclean in first century Judea. But this guy is covered with sores, and he can't even defend himself against the street dogs who had come and lick these oozing ulcers. This guy is pitiful. But apparently, the rich man walks by him every day, and if he sees him, and we know he sees him because later on he recognizes him, but he doesn't care. He's too absorbed in his own wealth. He's too absorbed in his own luxury that he doesn't take the time to try to relieve the suffering of this man at his gates. Now, I also think it's interesting that there's no mention that Lazarus is buried. It just says that he died and he goes to heaven. So likely, this man's corpse is thrown on a burning garbage pile down in the valley, or maybe buried in a pauper's grave. On the other hand, Dives, the rich man, is buried. He probably has been given all the pomp and circumstances of a good funeral. I read this week about a fellow by the name of Jeremy Bentham, who in the 19th century was a philanthropist and a rather rich man in England. He left his entire estate to the University of London. But see, rich people oftentimes, in their ostentatiousness and wanting to be noticed, they make sure that in order for people to get their money, they require certain things. And Jeremy Bentham required that his body must be present at all board meetings. And so, of course, the University of London, wanting his money, they had the good Jeremy Bentham taxidermied and put into what was kind of like a phone booth. And at the beginning of every meeting, it's glass enclosed. At the beginning of every meeting, they swing open the doors so that Jeremy Bentham is present at the meeting of the board. Now, that's what's going on earth. Now, what about in heaven? What about in the afterlife? Well, we see that Lazarus dies and he finds himself in the bosom of Abraham. Now, I know we have an African-American spiritual, but the bosom of Abraham. But what does that expression really mean? Because it sounds kind of weird. So what is it meaning the bosom of Abraham? Well, this is an expression for paradise, but it's reminiscent of the way that people dined. People would recline as they dined. They didn't sit up on straight back chairs. They reclined on couches. And since most people ate with their right hand, they would recline on their left hand like this. And their legs would be kind of stretched out this way. And so if you were to the right of someone that was the guest of honor or the host of the meal, you would be right in front of them as you were eating. You would be in the bosom of Abraham. You would be in front of them. So this what this is saying is that the poor man, Lazarus, finds himself right next to the father of Israel, right next to the founder of the people. He's being given himself a place of honor, and he's a poor beggar. Now, to first century Jewish culture, the poor were seen as cursed by God. So this would have seemed just really strange. The poor man was given the place of honor at this banquet in heaven. whereas the rich man finds himself in what we've translated often as hell. He's finding himself in a place of torment. Here's the important thing. He cries out to Father Abraham. And what does he cry out, this rich man who's now found himself tormented in this place of utter horror? He looks across and he sees Abraham and he sees Lazarus. And this is where the description of heaven and hell is kind of probably not something you'd want to base your theology on. Because if I'm in heaven, I don't know that I want to see the people in torment someplace else. And I'm sure those in torment probably don't see heaven. So I don't think we can base a lot of theology on that. But he cries out, and what does he ask? And this, I think, is interesting. He doesn't talk to Abraham. He doesn't talk to Lazarus. He's the one he recognizes, right? He talks to Abraham, and what does he say? Tell Lazarus to go do something for me. The rich man still sees Lazarus as beneath him. He still sees Lazarus as a servant-like person. Someone who is socially below his status. Tell that guy to go get some water and cool off my mouth. And Father Abraham says, no, doesn't work that way. I'd like to stop here for a moment and ask a question. Is this a morality tale about wealth and poverty? Is that what this is all about? That rich people go to hell and poor people go to heaven? Is that what this is about? Because some people have suggested that this is just simply a tale about the reversal of fortunes in the afterlife. And that's kind of scary, because if that's what this is all about, well, remember, Americans are all within like the top 10% in terms of wealth in the world's population. And if that's what this parable is all about, we've got some scary times ahead. Because many of the world's population live on a dollar a day. But I don't think that's what this parable is all about. And I have three reasons for that. And the first is the presence of Abraham. Now, Abraham's presence might simply be because that's the way that people talked about paradise. But I think that it's more than that. And that's why I included our reading this morning from James. Notice that in Genesis 13:2, Abraham is described as being wealthy. So if wealthy people go to hell and poor people go to heaven, that this doesn't work because Abraham's in heaven. He's wealthy. But there's a few differences there. In our reading from James this morning, you'll notice that James refers back to Abraham. And what does he talk about Abraham having? Abraham has faith. And not only does he have faith, but he puts his faith into action. And so in Genesis 12:2, it says that Abraham was blessed, but he was blessed so that he might be a blessing to others. So here in heaven we have Abraham, who himself had faith that his salvation was not of himself. His salvation was not based on his wealth. His salvation was based on faith and the grace of God. And then he used his wealth to be a blessing to others. Second, Lazarus' name. Now, we said that Lazarus' name means literally, God is my helper. I think that this is the character of Lazarus, that no matter what, he puts his faith in God. But there's another interesting thing about Lazarus' name. The name Eleazar actually is going back into Genesis as well. Eleazar of Damascus was Abraham's selfless servant. When Abraham needed a task done, no matter how difficult, Eleazar would go do it. And it happened that in first century Judea, Eleazar became sort of a character in popular stories. He was the random stranger that would show up, and it was an opportunity for you to offer a blessing to this random stranger and return, and in turn receive reward. What I think that the story is telling us is, in part, is that Lazarus is amongst us if we're looking out for him. Lazarus is the person in need. And if you're careful, if you're watching, it's an opportunity for you to give a blessing to Lazarus and in turn be blessed, just as the stories of the first century said. And there's a third reason that I don't think that this is a tale simply about wealth and poverty, and that has to do with the backstory, the context of our story this morning. If we go back to the portion of Luke just prior to our gospel, we go back to Luke 13, and Jesus says, "No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will love the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." Now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, also heard all these things, and they derided him. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts, for what is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God." And those are the verses that immediately precede our parable. So Jesus says a number of things in those verses. First, he says, you can't love both God and money. If you love money for money's sake, if you love money for your own comfort, you're missing the point. Second, the Pharisees are scoffing at Jesus, and so who is Dives really? Dives is a Pharisee. That's a warning to us. And then third, God knows your heart. God knows what's inside. What's highly esteemed by men is an abomination in the sight of God. My question to you is, what's your backstory this morning? What's in your heart? God knows your heart. And then, of course, there's the after story. And let's pick up our story where we left off. In the story, the last request that Dives makes to Abraham is, "Send Lazarus to my brothers." And Abraham says, "I'm sorry, they have Moses and the prophets." What are the Moses and the prophets saying? You might remember Moses and the prophets were summarized by Jesus when he said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength and all your mind." That was Moses summarized. And the prophets, "Love your neighbor as yourself." That's what Moses and the prophets said. And then furthermore, they said, "Look forward to the coming of a Messiah." Jesus here, I think, is foreshadowing his own death when he says, when he has Abraham saying, they won't even pay any attention if someone comes back from the dead. And I think it's ironic that Jesus is journeying to Jerusalem when this story is told, where he will weep for those who will crucify him, and then he will rise from the dead. And ironically, along the way, he will rise from the dead a man named Lazarus. So no, this is not a morality tale about wealth and poverty. John Wesley said, "It's no more sinful to be rich than to be poor. But," he said, "it's dangerous beyond expression." We all wrestle with this. I want to take care of myself too. I spend time looking at my bank accounts and retirement accounts, and is my money in the right place, and is my car a nice enough car? And, you know, we all do that. In politics, we hear this all the time right now in our political season. The world is either divided up between winners and losers, or it's divided up between capitalists and socialists. See, and in both of those situations, this is about how we see the world and how we see money. But no matter what economic system you hold to, as a Christian, you should have the same heart for the poor that Jesus does. Whatever political philosophy you hold to, you have to factor this in. For those who see Jesus as God's son, who put their trust in him and then through his eyes begin to see those in need around them and put their faith in action, as James says, all the bad you will ever have is here in this life. But for those who put their trust in riches and live only for themselves, failing to see either Jesus as the risen Son of God or those in need around them, all the good they will ever have will be here in this life. We have been given this great gift, this life of blessedness in the now. Let us use it to be a blessing, not to earn ourselves into heaven. Christ has already given us that, and there is nothing we can add to it. But rather, in response, we need to be a blessing to others. Just a few chapters earlier in Luke 9, Jesus said, "What good will it do for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their very souls?" So, let's make this life really count. Two final stories or thoughts. One was the story of Monica that I thought about on this Mother's Day. Monica, you might know, was the mother of Augustine. And Augustine went on to become one of the great fathers of the faith in the early Middle Ages. And he was influenced quite strongly by, Martin Luther was influenced quite strongly by Augustine. But Augustine didn't come to faith until he was in his 30s. He was born to a pagan father, and Monica, his mother, was a Christian. And Monica prayed fervently her whole life that Augustine would turn to faith in Christ. He didn't do so until his 30s, but she continued as a faithful mother to pray and to urge, to follow her son wherever he went in terms of countries, not in a weird way, but in terms of the countries that he lived in, to assist him and to help him and to teach him the faith. And finally, he did so just a few short years before she died. And then secondly, I'd like you to look at the insert that's in your bulletin. There's a prayer that we're going to be saying in just a few moments, but on the back side of that insert is a program that we're going to be doing here at Zohr and on the North Shore in cooperation with some other churches. This is a program to try to welcome the strangers amongst us and to try to be a blessing to them. There's a few ways that you can be involved in welcoming our international workers and seeing them as the stranger, seeing them as Lazarus at our gate. And I'd like to just ask you to prayerfully consider these different ways that you might be involved. Let's bow our heads as we close our sermon this morning. O glorious and holy God, I am no longer my own, but yours. Put me to what you will. Place me with whom you will. Put me to doing, put me to suffering. Let me be put to work for you or set aside for you, praised for you or criticized for you. Let me be full, let me be empty. Let me have all things, let me have nothing. I freely and fully surrender all things to your glory and service. And now, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, my Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer, you are mine and I am yours. And the covenant which I have made on earth, let it be ratified in heaven. Amen.